Today, the United States informed us they will be imposing 25% tariffs on Canadian exports to the United States and 10% on Canadian energy. Canada will be responding to the U.S. trade action with 25% tariffs against $155 billion worth of American goods. In this moment, we must pull together. Thank you. Merci. Vive le Canada.
The thing about this trade war is just that it's so stupid. If you shoot yourself in the foot, we'll show you. We'll shoot ourselves in the face. I mean, this cannot be said enough. All these headlines about Trump slapping tariffs on Canada makes it sound like he's slapping us, and I guess he is, indirectly. But the way that he does that is by slapping his own citizens. It's Americans who he's taxing. It's the U.S. government charging U.S. citizens outrageous levies when they buy Canadian products. And our comeback, Trudeau will slap Canadians. He'll slap his citizens in response. We're the ones who will have to pay our government retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods that we want to buy. Not Trump, not Americans. That is how a trade war goes. Two countries just slapping themselves in the face until one of them can't take it anymore and cries uncle. The whole thing is just so dumb. So, is there any other way to fight back? Something that is not dumb. Something smart. Well, Canadian novelist, essayist, and activist Cory Doctorow is one of the smartest people I know. And he has an idea. He thinks Canada should hit America back where it hurts. Right in the dongle. And late last week, when it became very clear that Trump was not bluffing, Cory joined me from his home in Burbank, California, to share this different idea, maybe a much better idea, for how Canada could fight back. Wait for it. Cory Doctorow, you have a different strategy. What is it?
Well, I like to think it's the politically canny strategy, which is rather than hitting Americans with a tariff that will make everything more expensive in Canada, we change a law that we passed in 2012 that makes it illegal for Canadians to improve or modify American products. And that has been used to stop Canadians from repairing stuff, from making their own app stores and so on, and draws just billions of dollars out of the Canadian economy every year and sends it to America and constitutes the highest profit margin of America's largest businesses, so that we would actually hit them really where it hurts rather than just hurting ourselves and hoping that they get so sad by watching us hurt ourselves that they change their minds.
Can you explain that? Like, what specifically is this that we're doing instead of just slapping tariffs on their stuff?
So in 2012, Canada passed a law that makes it illegal to bypass a digital lock on a copyrighted work. And so when you hear that, it sounds very abstract. But broadly speaking, because everything has software in it, what this law does is says that changing that software is illegal so long as there's a lock in front of it. And so if the software stops you from putting a third-party ink cartridge in your printer, then refilling or buying a third-party ink cartridge becomes a crime. And what that means is that the companies that sell you your ink can just ratchet up the price of ink because they know that you can't do anything about it. You have no self-help measures available to you. That's why ink is the most expensive fluid that you can buy as a consumer today. You print your grocery lists with fluid that costs more than the semen of a Kentucky Derby winning stallion. And
that's a handy reference point.
It is. I used to say vintage Veuve Clicquot, but I think my audience is more familiar with prize horse breeding than they are with fine French champagne. So I've switched to that one. But it also stops you, if you're a person with diabetes who has a continuous glucose monitor and an insulin pump, and you want to use some third-party software to connect the two, especially if you've got like a little kid who's in daycare and you want to be able to dose them with insulin when their glucose gets low without relying on like daycare workers. It stops you from changing the software in your glucose monitor. And this is a thing that people with diabetes do, but a thing that the law gets in the way of. It also means that like an independent mechanic can't fix your car without getting permission from the manufacturer, paying thousands of dollars if they can get permission at all to get a diagnostic tool. And it means that even if you put the manufacturer's own parts in your car or your tractor, the car and the tractor, they won't recognize those parts until an authorized technician types an unlock code in, and it's illegal to bypass the software so it doesn't need that unlock code. So this is why farmers can't fix their own tractors. It's also why people at hospitals couldn't fix their own ventilators. Medtronic, the largest ventilator manufacturer in the world, actually the largest med tech manufacturer in the world, uses the same gimmick. It's called parts pairing, to stop hospitals from repairing their own ventilators, and instead requires them to pay for a service call, which is bad like under normal circumstances, but like when there's no airplanes because there's a lockdown underway and also you need every ventilator you can get, this is literally lethal. So it just gets us out from under all of this, as well as, you know, quotidian stuff. Like if you buy an app from a Canadian app maker, a Canadian software author, as a Canadian, the payment for that app takes a round trip through Cupertino, California, Apple headquarters, and comes back 30% lighter. That's what Apple charges for payment processing. And I'll give you an idea of like what a normal payment processing fee is. Visa is being sued by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission for having payment processing fees in the 2 to 5% range, because that's considered monopolistic price gouging. Apple's charging 30% to process the payment. We could just have a Canadian app store. And the Canadian App Store would allow Canadian software authors and Canadian software users to transact mutually among each other without having to send 30% to a trillion-dollar company. And not only could Canadians use this store, but like anyone could. We could export this technology. We could export car fixing tools. We could export insulin pump fixing tools. We could export our app stores all around the world and become a powerhouse of repair, adaptation, and expansion for every smart product in the world that is currently serving as a kind of rent extractor for American tech companies.
Let me try to process that through my limited functions here. Because when you began, it sounded absurd. There's a guy in a kiosk in the kind of like low-grade mall near me mm-hmm. who has really long painted fingernails, and he will fill your inkjet cartridges for you. We call him the inkjet wizard. And there's always like, is this legal? It's a lot cheaper than buying the ones from Canon, so let's just do it here. And when you started talking about inkjet fluid as Canada's response to 25% tariffs with our largest trading partner upon whom our economy relies, that began sounding absurd, that would be in any way a meaningful response. But as you kind of went forward, I think I got my head around it. And you start with things like a Gillette razor, where you've got to buy Gillette razors for the Gillette razor blade stick. And so you're locked into their system and you can't seem to find other ones that'll stick on. And you extend that basically to everything, to the point where you're not owning your own stuff anymore. You buy a Tesla car and it can actually do all sorts of things that it won't let you do. It has all sorts of self-driving capabilities and boost modes that you have to pay an extra subscription fee.
It won't let you use your whole battery. You have to pay extra to use the whole battery. It only gives you 50% by default, and you have to pay a subscription if you want to use the whole battery in your car.
So as I think you accurately predicted many years ago when you used to come onto my tech show, this model of like, we don't own our stuff anymore, we basically are buying entrance to a platform through which these companies are just constantly upselling us into ongoing subscription fees, all the while they're surveying us and sucking data from us. And if we try to fix our own stuff or buy a cable for our tech that is not from that same company, they could even shut it down and brick it. And you were warning me many years ago that this is the model through which everything is increasingly going to flow. And I think we could go through example after example. You're saying like John Deere farming equipment, where farmers, like, you bought a very expensive piece of machinery. There's a Canadian company that makes attachments for the front so that your tractor can do something else. It can be a thresher. Because you didn't buy your tractor. You're like in a licensing agreement with John Deere where they actually can like remotely control your shit. So first we've got that concept. And what you're saying is Canada has willfully entered into a trade agreement with the states that not only allows them to do this, but criminalizes Canadians when we try to get around it. So 25% tariff on American goods, we're already paying huge tariffs, right, in the form of these fees. And I know this from my business because Canada Land, you know, you can become a Canada Land supporter through our website. But if you become a Canada Land supporter through Apple, through the podcast app on Apple, they take 30%. Like, it's many multiples, the fee. And we allow that, and we're happy to get those subscriptions because the convenience factor of the fact that they have market dominance and the majority of our listeners listen to us through Apple, that might be the only way we're getting that subscriber. So we'll take it. It's better than nothing. Stop me if I'm getting any of this wrong.
No, I think you're getting it right. I think the one gloss that I put on this is to point out that when you look at the balance sheets of these companies, that their most profitable line of business is this stuff, right? So this isn't just about getting Canadians a better deal. This is about striking the only companies that are keeping the S&P 500 afloat. You look at the last 10 years of the S&P 500, it's in the red except for big tech stocks.
Yeah.
And you're striking at their highest profit margin business lines while making Canadians richer without making Canadians poorer by making anything more expensive.
Which is what a 25% tariff, if we retaliated with just that kind of brute force dumb instrument, we would be screwing ourselves over while making life harder for them. And then it's a game of chicken as to who flinches first. Instead, we would just say, you know what? This was what you demanded the last time Chrystia Freeland sat down for the USMCA, that you have to respect America's digital locks. And really, in allowing this stuff to happen, like, how many things that used to be like a domestic industry are now mediated through an American tech company that takes like a big skim, you know, taxi driving, Uber and Lyft. You know, these are whole industries that we handed big chunks over to the states. So it's not quotidian piddly shit. They would notice this hits them where it hurts. This hits them in the tech sector, which is propping up their economy. That's your idea.
Yeah. And let me tell you how it worked with taxis. So right now, the biggest problem with, like, you know, Beck cabs or whatever doing their own app is that you don't know how many cars there are on the road that have that app. And because of that, you don't bother installing it. And because of that, no drivers install it either. But if a co-op of drivers or a livery cab company wanted to make an app and you were allowed to reverse engineer the Uber app on your phone, you could page a car with an Uber and then, using a back channel, find out whether that car was participating in another app. And if it was, tear down the ride you just booked and rebook it as a ride through the back app. So it would allow drivers and customers to always get the closest car. But when that car had chosen to get outside of Uber and when the rider had chosen to get outside of Uber, your phones could automatically sense that and split the difference rather than paying rent to Uber, the 30% that Uber is taking out of that ride. So everybody gets a cheaper ride. The driver gets a fatter paycheck and it just comes out of Uber's back end, which is mostly, like, you know, let's be clear, Saudi royal family, right? They're the big shareholders in Uber. So, you know, you're just screwing over SoftBank and the Saudi royal family and those people can all go jump. So that's fine.
I'm loving all of this, and I'm going to keep going down this flight of fancy until I tell you why it would never work, which I'm pretty sure it wouldn't.
Okay.
But continue to dream for a moment. In addition to all of our gig workers are now in co-ops where they're not paid pennies on the dollar for what some foreign company makes, the consumer is getting a better deal. You can jailbreak your Tesla.
Yeah, yeah.
You bought it.
A Canadian garage can sell you a one-time fee that unlocks all the downloadable content, subscription content in your Tesla. And then when you sell your Tesla, you can charge more for your used Tesla than you could otherwise. Right now, if you do a bunch of aftermarket mods to your Chevy and then you sell that Chevy, it's worth more.
Yeah.
But if you pay for aftermarket mods to your Tesla, Tesla erases those mods.
Those mods being the subscriptions for the self-driving mode and this.
Yeah, use of the battery, whatever, all that other stuff.
So whatever, I can buy my beast mode and my battery mode and my this mode, but when I go to sell my Tesla, they just strip it and the next guy's got to, he's got
to buy it again, but you could keep it.
So now in this Cory Doctorow Wonderland, I paid at my friendly neighborhood hacker at a garage to jailbreak my Tesla. And now I've got a Tesla that can do all and I keep that value in the resale market. Canadians win.
Yeah.
Elon Musk loses.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to punish the guy with the Nazi salutes,
okay,
don't just like make fun of him. Like take money out of his pocket. Take money out of his pocket.
Let's talk about how this helps Jesse Brown. Right now, Canadian law protects the digital locks on Apple Podcasts, but no, we're going to tear that down and we're going to offer subscription products, not just for podcasts, if you want premium podcasts, but for the, you know, much more lucrative app market. And I think you said something that if we had in Canada a completely open marketplace taking like a 5%, 4%, 3% fee instead of 30%, it wouldn't just be Canadians that could buy their apps there, but we could offer this to any consumers out in the world as long as they could get their iPhones jailbreaked, you know, through whatever means, you know. And then we're now actually drinking their milkshake, because instead of them being the place where all of the offshore dollars get sent to, it all passes through Canada, but at a much more favorable rate.
Yeah. Imagine you're like a smart, you know, Waterloo engineering student who actually finishes your degree, unlike me. I dropped out of Waterloo after my first year there. But say you finish your degree at Waterloo. You go to some person who's sitting on some Research in Motion millions, and you say, I want to start an app store. And I want you to give me some money, not just for the apps and not just for like a little jailbreaking dongle that unlocks your iPhone and lets you install the App Store. I want to do sales calls on the 10% of apps that produce 90% of the revenue for Apple. And I'm going to offer them special teaser rates to come and be not exclusive, just like on my store, but to offer a lower rate for everything they sell. So your Fortnite skins are 25% cheaper if you get them through the store. And then you go around the world and you say, hey, kids, do you like playing Fortnite? Install the Canadian App Store and all the you buy in the game is 25% cheaper. And Epic, who make Fortnite, still makes more money than they would with Apple.
Corey, it sounds great. Why the would they let us do it?
What are they going to do? Impose a tariff?
No, we're going to be like Cuba repairing like 1950s cars for the next 70 years. They're going to stop selling us this stuff.
You know, I wouldn't bet on it. For one thing, as with Canadian pharma, one of the great beneficiaries of this kind of market is Americans, right? It's not like Americans are exempt from this ripoff. They're also printing their shopping lists with Winning Stallion semen, you know, and so they will benefit from this gray market as well. Money talks, bullshit walks. If you think that Trump is going to invade us if we don't capitulate, then why talk about any kind of response to a tariff? Why talk about a 25% Canadian tariff? Why don't we just give them anything they want? I mean, that is more or less what Justin Trudeau did with USMCA. It didn't help, right? Like, we tried that once. It was a catastrophe. So why would we do it again?
Well, I don't think it's widely viewed as a catastrophe. Here's the actual question here. There is a current crisis in Canada around a very real problem. Like, I find this a delightful conversation. It's a really fun one. But if large tariffs are placed on our export markets, then Canadians suffer almost immediately. And the cost of everything is going to go up in Canada, and industries, we can call them what we want. We can say that our natural resource-based economies are really backwards and we haven't kept up. We've capitulated to the Americans too much. But that is the country that we have right now. And people are going to suffer really badly. And the American system of forcing trade partners into their regime, some would argue this has been good for everybody. There are developing nations around the world that want into these trade relationships. Canada's lucky to have access to the American market, and it's a small price to pay to allow them to set the terms of tech. It's almost like if what you're saying is legitimate and this would seriously hurt them and threaten them, why would we endanger the basic relationship through which so much of our economy relies, so that we could, you know, legally use off-brand inkjet cartridges?
I mean, the thing Trump wants us to stop doing in order to avoid these tariffs is a thing we're already not doing, right? Which is he wants us to stop criminals from using the Canadian border to enter America. That's just not a thing that is happening, right, in any real numbers.
But if we dance around and say, oh, you're right there, boss. That was a big problem. We got some helicopters there now, and it's all solved, to placate him and go back. That's what everybody wants right now, is just to go back.
I think if that were the case, they wouldn't bother, right? That the point here is to be seen to be doing something for their base. I don't think they really have a serious demand that Canada can meet. So sure, let's stipulate that Canada could put a giant inflatable helicopter at the border along with a bunch of standees of Canadian soldiers and like hand letter a sign that says Canadian Border Defense Force and then take a picture of it and show it to Trump. And he says, okay, no 25% tariff. Okay, why not? But we're talking here about a world in which Trump actually imposes the 25% tariff. So Trump imposes this 25% tariff. The fact that this is hard on Canadians, okay, true, does not mean that we shouldn't do the thing that that is hardest on Americans and makes things cheaper for Canadians, because one of the things you really want is to make things cheaper for Canadians. The other thing that's happening in the American market is it's really stagnant. So American capital has nowhere to go. You see this with the AI bubble and so on. There's just no alpha, right? There's no gains to be had because you have monopolists who sucked up all the margin. Now, as Jeff Bezos said when he started Amazon, your margin is my opportunity. So, you know, Canada could be a site to which American capital could flow to start businesses. I mean, you know, American venture capital is not committed to American business. They're committed to profit.
We try to describe ourselves as more than just drawers of water and hewer of wood, and you know that we actually are this information economy. Here's a golden opportunity to become one.
Yeah.
So maybe there is a reality to this. I mean, and maybe this doesn't have to be discussed in such extremes, because they're talking about like a targeted tariff for tariff, tit for tat. A lot of this is like brinksmanship. Of like, are we doing this permanently, or are we just demonstrating that we can? Because that's where this starts, is Trump demonstrating what he can do. So if we demonstrated that we can start with it, see how they like that, and that becomes a bargaining chip, we could back off perhaps, you know.
Although I wouldn't want us to.
I know you don't. Corey, I'm trying to figure out how much you're trying to sandwich a long-running desire of yours into a solution for Canada's crisis of the moment.
Oh, look, I'm Milton Friedman here. So Milton Friedman in the 70s, they would say like, Milton, everyone thinks your ideas are terrible. You want to tear down the New Deal and return us to serfdom. How are you going to get people to go along with this? And he would say, in times of crisis, ideas can move from the periphery to the center. Our job is to keep good ideas lying around. And, you know, Satan took Milton Friedman to hell in the early 2000s. I like to think that every time that I quote his words, he like gargles a curse around that red hot spit poking out of his jaw as the demons turn it and flog him and pelt him with hot shit. But he was right. We live in Milton Friedman's world because his crank ideas and that during the oil crisis moved from the periphery to the center. We are having a Trump crisis, right? And there are ideas from the periphery that are moving to the center right now that are ideas like we should have pogroms. Right, we should deny the humanity of people. Those are not good ideas moving from the periphery to the center. We should spy on more people. We should build gulags.
But your radical idea
is a good one.
Yeah, maybe. Corey, everything that you've put forward suggests that nothing is preordained or as it should be in the way that we consume technological services or use our tech, that all of this is the result of policy. All of this is the result of an oligarch class that has gotten its way with American lawmakers, American negotiators, and ultimately with Canadians who capitulated. And the reason why I have the phone that I have, and the reason why I don't have the phone that I could have, or the car that I could have, or the price that I could have, is because of all of these.
Or the subscriber dollars you could have.
Or the subscriber dollars I could have is because of these systems. What if that's not true? What if people like their Apple products and they could have a slightly more open Android product, but a lot of people choose their Apple product. They could have products and services that they could open up and repair themselves or modify themselves, but they like the user experience of the uniformity. They like the security that comes with that. What if people like it this way?
I've heard this a lot, and I think that it is an unfalsifiable proposition, and we have to look to the kind of actions of firms. So, you know, Apple probably understands its customers' preferences pretty well. They spend a lot of money researching it. They have a kind of God's eye view of how customers use it. And they don't act like their customers are happy with this stuff, right? They spend to block third-party payment apps, to block third-party manufacturer, to block third-party app stores. Apple and the other large manufacturers, they had a coalition that defeated, I believe it was 20 right-to-repair bills at the state level in the United States in 2018, 2019, and they spent like an ungodly fortune on this, right? They didn't just like, it wasn't just like a side hustle, right? Like they took money that they could have given to their shareholders and they spent a fortune. Now, if you were convinced that no Apple customer would ever take their iPhone to anywhere but the Genius Bar to get it fixed, the fact that there's a guy on a folding table at the mall with long, weird fingernails who can fix your iPhone shouldn't matter. But when you look at Tim Cook's letter to his investors in the first quarter of 2019, he opens every year with an investor letter. He says the biggest threat to Apple's profits is that customers are keeping their phones and getting them fixed instead of replacing them every year. And then that's the year that he kills 20 right-to-repair bills, right? So this is not a guy who acts like he has the best product. This is a guy who acts like if you had a choice, you'd take it. I'm skeptical of many things that Tim Cook says. And maybe I'm being selective when I believe him when he says this, but I think he's right about this. I think that if you didn't force Apple customers to use Apple's App Store and Apple's repair depots and Apple's parts and Apple's everything, that a significant fraction of them would choose to do otherwise, especially if the app vendors were offering discounts for people who chose to use a third-party App Store.
Look, my kid is the same age that I was when I found the right screwdriver that I could open up the back of my 386 and install my own math coprocessor and extra RAM so that I could run 3D animation software. And those are delights that my child will never know. My children have never opened up an electronic device in their lives. And I would love to set back the clock, and I would love for them to know a little bit about what is under that beautiful piece of molded plastic. But that's not the world we live in anymore. But I get inspired when I talk to you. Maybe it could be. Maybe it could be.
No one came down off a mountain on 2 stone tablets and said that everything is going to be glued shut instead of screwed shut from now on. It was a choice we made. It's a policy choice we made in living memory. People are very happy to seek out a bargain. People drive around the block looking for gas that's like, you know, 1 cent a liter cheaper. You're telling me that, you know, kids who are trying to spend their pocket money wisely won't install another app to save 30% on their Fortnite skins? I think they will. I certainly would have.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a poor student, we shopped at the used food store where you could buy open packages of food for a nickel that people had opened up in the grocery store and taken a handful out of, right? You know, this is a market that is waiting to be tapped.
You know, I'm on this treadmill where I'm looking to buy a new phone, and I'm like, why am I looking to buy a new phone? It's because my old iPhone is slow ever since I was sort of forced into updating the iOS. And the new one's got a better camera. If I could go and swap out the camera for $100, mm-hmm. like why am I thinking of going and buying a $1,500 camera?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But then I kind of think like, it's the new one. I want the new one.
Right.
I can talk myself into that when I don't have a choice because my phone's just getting increasingly slow. But if I had that choice, you know, if I had $100 for a new camera
and a nice fresh battery
versus the $1,500 new purchase,
mm-hmm.
I would do that. Cory Doctorow, it's always mind-boggling. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. It was nice to talk to you again.
That is your Canada Land episode. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com, and I post sometimes to Blue Sky. You can find me there. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Max Collins is our director of audio, and Max also did the fact check on this episode. Our theme music is by So Called Syndication, handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. We'll talk a bit about that pipeline we never built that might have come in handy right about now. We'll talk about OpenAI's new complaint. Somebody scraped their information without permission to build an AI. So now they know how that feels. Mostly, we'll be answering the question, what's worse than an American president who picks on minorities? A Canadian politician who picks on minorities only after an American president does it first. This guy, Poilievre, he went from mimicking Stephen Harper to mimicking Donald Trump. It's like he's only aware of two options.
I'm only aware of two, but I mean, if you come up with another list, then you're welcome to do that. But I'm aware of two.
Wait for that. Hey, Dale Smith, freelance journalist and author, political columnist for Extra, LGBTQ news site people should check out. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. So, Dale, we're going to talk about the Canadian reverberations of Trump's stance on gender.
It will henceforth be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female.
So that's what Trump says, and then the question is put to Pierre Poilievre on CP24.
On his first day on the job, President Trump signed an executive order, the U.S. government only recognizing two genders, male, female. They're unchangeable. You know, if elected as prime minister, is that something that you're going to kind of walk in line with, or what are your feelings on that executive order?
Well, I don't know. Do you have any other genders that you'd like to name?
Me personally?
Yes.
I'm just asking more so if you're in line with what he is saying. Do you agree with what he's saying? Is that something that you would be lockstep with if elected as prime minister?
Well, I'm not aware of any other genders than men and women. I mean, if you have any other that you want me to consider, you're welcome to tell me right now.
Well, there's personally, I am a man. I am a, as okay. people say, cis man. There are people there who, they say they're
me too.
Gender neutral.
Well.
You are a man, yes. There are people there who say they're gender neutral. Yeah, they say they're gender neutral. They're a trans person. Is that something that you would recognize here? Whereas in the States, at least with their U.S. government, the way they're seeing it, there's only two.
I'm only aware of two, but I mean, if you come up with another list, then you're welcome to do that. But I'm aware of two. And as far as I'm concerned, we should have a government that just minds its own damn business and leaves people alone to make their own personal decisions.
Mm-hmm. A lot to say about this, but I think the place that I want to start is just by noting that he is lying. I'm not aware of any gender besides men and women. You're not aware of transgender people? Like, maybe you don't think that they're real or something, but you're saying you're not aware. Like, this is new information that you're just receiving right now. He's like, that's a lie.
He's never heard of a non-binary person. He's never heard of someone who's got they, them pronouns.
He's never heard that every now and then the doctor delivers a baby and it's not quite clear whether it's blue or pink for the nursery. He's not aware. There's a bare minimum of journalistic questioning that is lacking in that exchange, because I think what he is suggesting is, and he said this elsewhere, he considers trans people dudes in dresses who want to go into women's bathrooms and beat women at sports.
Obviously, female sports, female change rooms, female bathrooms should be for females, not for biological males.
So if that's what he thinks, then he should be questioned about that so he can clarify if that's what he thinks trans people are. The other thing, Dale, I want to hear what you have to say about this, but I'm going to go off for just another second here. This is now a genre of Pierre Poilievre media clip. We saw it before when he was chomping on an apple, where the unprepared journalist asks him a loaded question, and then he just seems completely indifferent. He's just, and he actually flips it, so he's asking the journalist the question. And he seems like the one who's very reasonable.
On the topic, I mean, in terms of your sort of strategy currently, you're obviously taking the populist pathway.
What does that mean?
well, appealing to people's more emotional levels, I would guess. Certainly you tap very strong ideological language quite frequently.
Like what?
I think that this is why he does Canadian news interviews at this point, is that to create these clips where he seems so reasonable and he leaves these journalists sputtering, because this anchor on CP24 can't ask a simple follow-up question. Like, are you saying the transgender people don't exist, or you just don't recognize them? What are you saying? If I were Jenny Byrne, who is Polyev's top strategist, I'd be trying to think of new ways for Pierre Polyev to seem like a dick. I would be trying to do this every day. What could he do? He could be like yawning or chewing gum while he delivers an interview. He could be playing Pokemon Go on his phone. He could be like cleaning his ear. He could check his watch and then like put up his hand. You know what time it is? Time to end this woke nonsense. Rather than dog whistling, he could actually just start whistling.
Yeah, very true that this has become a genre of Polyev interview. And the other thing too is, I mean, on the CP24 clip, if you go a little further on, the anchor does try to press a little more about, well, what about recognition of people who have an X gender marker and passports?
The current government, they currently have passports that allow people to put on, you know, gender neutral on their passport.
But at that point, Polyev just completely changes the subject.
Is that something that you would advocate for?
I have to be honest with you. I just saw your segment on homeless encampments that are popping up all over Toronto. We've got 25% of our population in poverty. Housing costs have doubled. Crime is rampaging through our streets. I just find it to be a strange priority to spend time talking about this.
So he's got his clip. He's made the anchor sputter. And then when the anchor composes himself enough to ask an actual question on how this is going to impact Canadians, Polyev then completely changes the subject and tries to go back to, I want to talk about these very reasonable things, and here you're talking about some woke nonsense, because that's how he will always frame these things, and therefore go back to this trope of common sense, which is something that conservatives transnationally, transatlantically, have been trying to play into, because it allows them to, what they see as, claim the rational high ground in an argument, because they know that they can't make the moral high ground.
Can you talk about that as a journalist who covers queer issues? Because when Polyev says, I just want to leave this alone and get out of people's business, the suggestion is that any kind of invitation to discuss these issues of sexuality, gender, identity are overreach of government. And he's positioning himself not as an anti-trans or anti-queer voice, but as a kind of libertarian, like, look, let's move past all of this nonsense and just talk about stuff that matters. What are the actual policy implications of what Trump is doing and what Polyev is now suggesting he's going to follow in the footsteps of?
There's kind of two parts to that question. The first one is that he also tries to spin these kinds of things, so any recognition of trans issues or what we've been seeing in several of the provinces around these so-called parental rights questions where trans youth are involved, is that he is essentially insinuating that these are politicians who are inserting narratives into children's brains, or who are attacking families, or that kind of thing. He's positioning himself as kind of like, I'm the sane one here. I'm on the side of parents. You are somehow trying to corrupt these children with your woke nonsense, because again, this is how he always frames these issues. It's kind of like him claiming in that interview with Peterson that we had to invent and import racism into Canada.
By the way, put aside race, this obsession with race that wokeism has reinserted.
Well, invented even.
Invented, I mean, in many ways.
It's the same kind of a construction, because he's saying that by other parties or other politicians discussing these issues, they're inventing them where there is no problem, when that's not really the case. But that is how he's trying to position his own dismissal of these issues. As for how these things play out in Canada, we mentioned the gender markers and passports, but he's already decided to make an issue of trans people in prisons, which is a federal issue for correctional purposes. It's hard to see whether he's going to start defunding human rights tribunals or so on who concern themselves with these issues, because he wants to essentially insinuate that these organizations are creating problems where none exist.
I think it's worth noting that if Pierre Poilievre is only aware of two genders, he wants to run a country that is aware of a wider spectrum of gender than that. Like, that is not in line with Canadian law. In 2017, C-16 passed. C-16 added the words gender identity or expression in three places in Canadian policy. It was added to the Canadian Human Rights Act. It was added to a section of the Criminal Code targeting hate speech. And it was added to the Criminal Code dealing with sentencing for hate crimes. So gender beyond male and female exists in Canadian law. Like, our systems are aware of it. So now we have to kind of wonder, like, well, what does it mean to have a conservative leader and possible prime minister who claims to not even be aware of these other categories or ways that human beings can be? Does that suggest that he is going to strip our policies of these distinctions, as Trump is trying to do in America? All right, after the break, we will hear what Pierre Poilievre said when Global News tried to actually press him on his statements about gender. When pushed for a follow-up by Global News, when Pierre Poilievre was asked, like, what exactly do you mean about this? All he was able to cite are these kind of like rage farming edge cases.
I'm asking you if we could expect similar legislation if you became prime minister as Donald Trump.
What other genders would you add to the list? My policies on this have been very clear. No men in women's prisons, sports, or bathrooms. We believe that it's inappropriate for dudes to be in women's prisons, in women's sports, and in women's bathrooms.
He wants to talk about the trans issue purely in the scope of radical queer theory that your kids are being indoctrinated with, and dudes in women's change rooms, dudes in sports, dudes in women's prisons. Trans people aren't Santa Claus. They're real. They are a minority. And within that minority is the tiny, like, when we talk about these cases, which I think we can talk about them. And I do think that there has been an overzealous response to shut down conversation about these edge cases when they pop up. And I think that reasonable people can discuss some of these instances in sports and prisons. There was this really concerning murder case in Quebec where this individual, Levana Balouz, found guilty of fatally stabbing their partner, suffocating their two children, identified as trans. And critics are saying, well, this is obviously a ploy to get into women's prison. I think that, like, these are newsworthy stories. We can talk about them. But Poilievre wants to only talk about these issues through these kind of tabloidy, extreme, anger-making cases that have the impact of generating a lot of hatred towards the overwhelming majority of trans people who are not involved in either indoctrinating your child at school or putting on a dress so they can get into a women's prison.
Yeah, it's making a blanket case out of an exception, using one to tar the entire community. And in this particular case, I'm sure that correctional services will have some kind of assessment mechanism for whether they believe that this individual is trying to game the system and where they should best be placed in terms of security and so on, because that's what the correctional service does. They have their own systems for doing these things, and it shouldn't be up to politicians to write policy for the correctional service for the sake of clips on social media.
Let me give some credit to the CBC here, who quantified what I was sort of struggling to articulate earlier, just the degree to which these stories are outliers, these stories that have eclipsed all conversation of issues that do matter to trans people writ large. So here's Steve Rukavina writing about this Quebec murder case, putting it in context. Out of a total population of 13,000 offenders in federal custody, 12 offenders made 19 total requests, because some offenders made multiple requests, to be placed or transferred based on gender identity. And of those requests, 6 were approved, 10 were refused, and 3 were withdrawn. And the reasons for accepting or refusing a particular request are confidential. We did a whole series on pretendians, in which we talked about the lax systems whereby self-identification as Indigenous was being exploited by white and non-Indigenous prisoners to get into Indigenous programs.
I need to tell you how big a problem this whole thing is. One reporter investigated these programs, and according to her sources, the majority of so-called Indigenous prisoners were not actually Native.
There is, I think, a reasonable conversation to be had about how self-identification can be exploited by bad actors. But in the case of people who are willing to actually lie about their gender identification in order to get shifted to a different kind of prison, like we are talking about, you could count on your fingers and toes the number of people. And the fact that not all of these requests were approved supports what you were saying, Dale, which they're not just rubber stamping all of these requests. There seems to be some level of scrutiny that's placed on them. So it does just an incredible disservice to people who've had to fight for like decades to get the modicum of policy recognition that they have to be used as a political football in this way. What bugs me about it is the bullying, just picking on people who you can engender a lot of bad feeling. There's still a lot of prejudice and disgust, and there seemed to be a level of disgust that Polyev was. These things are hard to describe, but when he's like, I'm not aware of other genders, I picked up on something that he was playing to, I think, an uglier part of his base.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, part of this is a certain element of monkey see, monkey do when it comes to the MAGA crowd that he is very much trying to hang on to for his electoral ambitions, because he sees moving to the further right and capturing voters who typically do not vote to get him over the edge to win a government than he would in terms of playing to the center. Also in part because the conservatives convinced themselves that the previous two leaders tried to play to the center and it failed for them, even though they didn't actually really play to the center, and some last-minute conversions on the road to Damascus didn't convince the population that they were actually serious about any kind of policies that were trying to appeal to centrists. So it's part of this move to keep this particular base, and we see that this base is very motivated by the Fox News out there, who are motivated by the kind of lurid stories on social media about trans people. The one that keeps coming up is sterilizing children. Well, we don't perform any kind of gender affirmation surgeries on people under the age of 18. So they're coming in with these horror stories that they have read somewhere on the internet. And these are things that Polyev is playing to. I don't know if he necessarily believes them, but he is necessarily playing to these fears amongst this population, because that's how he thinks that they're going to get a response at the ballot box.
I don't care what he actually believes or who he actually likes or hates, but we can look at his words and his record. And it is interesting to look throughout his political career how he modulates his level of bigotry to what is acceptable. And he steps back. And there's a cowardice and an opportunism, like, you know, even if you have terrible views, like one can maybe appreciate on some level, like, well, they think what they think. You know, this guy, I remember when he insulted Indigenous people and said that what they really need is, you know, to pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Learn the value of hard work.
We need to engender the values of hard work and independence and self-reliance. That's the solution in the long run. More money will not solve it.
He stepped outside of Harper's level of what was acceptable to say at a time when Harper was apologizing for the residential schools. And Pierre at the time took his punishment and went and apologized for saying that.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to offer a full apology to Aboriginal people, to the House, and to all Canadians. Yesterday, on a day when the House and all Canadians were celebrating a new beginning, I made remarks that were hurtful and wrong.
It seems like very little has changed when he was trying to kind of modulate this culture war stuff very subtly before Trump took a big swing, you know, and he was sort of limiting himself to things like radical queer theory in the schools, you know, like, well, let's just keep this out of the schools and not want to be seen like he's bullying trans people, until Trump made that okay. And then the question is put to him, are you going to do the same thing? And he goes, well, I'm only aware of two genders. So what other genders are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it has to do with the permission structures that Trump and his win have put into place. And because he has created a permission structure for this kind of rhetoric, Polyev now says, this is acceptable in the discourse now, so therefore I can play to this. That's kind of how permission structures tend to work.
You wouldn't want to be like a laggard falling behind on taking shots at trans people. You know, you don't want Trump to be one-upping you in that respect. If the narrative is shifted there and Canadians are following Trump more than they're following Canadian stuff, let's take the rhetoric there. Dale, we're going to duly note some stories that our listeners might otherwise miss. What do you have today?
I want to duly note the notion that Energy East pipeline can somehow be signed off on. We saw some news stories this last week where after the premier's meeting, premiers like Tim Houston said the government needs to approve Energy East, but the problem is that the project doesn't exist. It's a dead letter. Building this mythology that there are all of these pipeline projects that are just sitting on a desk waiting for a signature before they can happen, and that's not actually true. I think that Canadian newsreaders are particularly given a disservice if we're not actually being given proper context on why these projects did not advance. And everyone will say, oh, it's because Trudeau brought in C-69. No, most of these projects were not approved long before that legislation came in, as well as to actually have a conversation about what that means for prices. If we did have a pipeline that shipped Alberta crude west to east, A, there are no refineries in the east who could actually process it, and B, they would be paying a whole lot more per barrel for the privilege of Alberta oil than they can currently get on the world market. So these are conversations that we are absolutely not having when it comes to a premier saying, well, we need more east-west pipelines. Okay, well, there's a whole lot more to that story, and absolutely nobody is actually spelling that out.
Duly noted. I want to duly note a story that I think some people are going to be familiar with. The details, though, I just love this story. It's reported widely in lots of places, but here's the Globe and Mail's version. Chinese startup DeepSeek sinks AI tech stocks as little-known firm upstages Silicon Valley giants. So it's written as a business story, fair enough, because like the business impacts here are huge. NVIDIA, which is a leading maker of chips that are used to power AI, their shares fell 17% when this news came out, shaving roughly $550 billion from its market cap. Canadian impacts here, big, big impacts for Canadian company Celestica, which builds equipment for data centers. Their shares plummeted 26%. Some energy companies which power the data centers did not escape either. Canada's Capital Power Corp lost 15% of its market value. All of this investment, heavy investment, like huge amounts of money in training AI models and the energy needed for AI and the processing power for AI, billions of dollars. And here comes DeepSeek releasing a large language model called V3 in December, following it up just recently with another one called R1, a reasoning model that can handle more complex questions and problems than standard chatbots. Okay, so is this just a question of China beating us in the AI arms race? No, it's how they did it. Here is what it cost DeepSeek. They said they spent $5.6 million US to train one of its models. $5.6 million. US companies are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to train individual models, while research firm Epoch AI has estimated that building the largest AI models will cost more than $1 billion US in 2027. Not only did DeepSeek appear to dramatically undercut development costs, it claims to have done so using a relatively small number of NVIDIA chips that are not even state-of-the-art, because the U.S. has attempted to restrict the export of advanced chips to China in recent years to thwart the company's progress in AI. So they've been essentially like hooking up a bunch of Game Boys together and have cracked AI, and then they released it for free. They released it open source. So all of this crazy speculation in AI, this massively inflated balloon. It's like China's just like, here you go. And now everyone's playing with DeepSeek to see, like, the hype over AI is out of control, but I did not see this coming. You knew there was going to be some kind of a correction, but for China just to be like, here, we did this, everybody can have it, was not the correction that I was anticipating.
No, the words that stood out to me in the couple of pieces I did read about this were the claims to. And I don't know how much independent verification there has been for any of these claims and whether the claims that they are not using the same amount of data centers and so on is actually true. We have seen stories in the past where people have kind of stood up Potemkin villages and saying that they're getting these things that are smaller, faster, cheaper, when in fact there's a whole bunch of back-end infrastructure that is not necessarily being seen. I have to wonder how much of that is actually going to be verified in a situation like this. I do think that people need to remember that sometimes these AI miracles are just a Turk machine, and that the history of hoaxes for these new technologies is vast, and we should maintain a skeptical eye.
We just did a look at AI the Monday before last, where we talked about how a lot of these claims that AI companies make, well, actually, there's just like a room full of people. And now we also have OpenAI complaining, saying that, hey, wait a second, DeepSeek stole their training data. They stole OpenAI's training data. Where did OpenAI get its training data? OpenAI stole all of our data, and now it's been stolen by this Chinese AI company who have released it to the world open source. Delicious. The Globe and Mail did mention that DeepSeek does seem to have some limitations on what it will answer based on its country of origin. This came to light when they asked it about what happened in Tiananmen Square.
Of course.
And it said, let's talk about something else.
Duly noted.
All right, I'm going to be back with one last thing I want to talk about, but first we're going to say goodbye to Dale. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Dale, where can people find you and your work?
You can find me on Blue Sky at Journo Dale, and that's all one word. And I'm still occasionally over on Twitter at Journo _ Dale.
All right, that's our show for today. Thank you for listening to it. You can email me about anything you heard at jesse@canadaland.com. And I'm posting some stuff on Blue Sky. You can check me out there. This episode is produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Fact check by Noor Azria. I'm Jesse Brown, the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Just a ghost. I remember you the most. You're not real, you're just a ghost. Not really, you're just a ghost.